Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Good morning, everybody. Happy Thursday. Welcome back to the show. Today, I wanted to have a conversation about a topic that has been on basically everyone's mind. That's a potential conflict in Ukraine. We did an episode of Joseph Weisberg, creator of The Americans, giving one perspective on the Ukraine-Russia-NATO debate. I decided to bring on a slightly different voice, but one that I knew for sure would resonate with our audience. A few weeks ago, Sagar and I went on Hidden Forces, which is an amazing podcast hosted by Dmitry Kofinas. Dmitry is interested in the idea of a realignment. He's interested in the show. He shared a lot of the interests and the focuses of our listeners. So I thought if we were going to have the discussion about Ukraine, NATO, how things should look moving forward, we should have it with someone who would really resonate with the audience. And Dmitry does that excellently. This conversation goes a bunch of different places, and it also ends on a more personal note that we really haven't really gotten into before. So it was great to have that opportunity. So hope you enjoy the show. And once again, cannot recommend Hidden Forces more than anything. We did a great episode of him a few weeks back. We will put that in the show notes as well. Two, quick show rundown before we go in. One, Dmitry doesn't have a book, but lots of authors who've come on the show do have books. So we'd love for you to go follow our bookshop link. It's in the show notes. If you want to purchase a book, support a bookseller, support a local publisher, an independent press, and most importantly, help the show get a bit of dough to keep the lights on. Two, it's Thursday. Didn't publish last week, but there's an actual Substack coming this week. It's going to be great. Come check it out. Come subscribe. We're about to hit 4,000 subscribers. So at this point, I'm going to have to actually start taking this really seriously. Finally, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. Hope you enjoy the episode. Dmitry Kofinas, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you, Marshall. It's great being on the podcast.
I almost said welcome back to The Realignment, but that was because a couple weeks ago, you, Sagar, and I did a really excellent episode on your podcast, Hidden Forces. I recommend that once folks finish this episode, if they haven't listened to your stuff already, they go check out Hidden Forces. It's really cool. You talked about this. We hit a lot of guests independently, but because we have slightly different perspectives and experiences, that they're hit from different angles. So if you like The Realignment, you'll really like Hidden Forces and vice versa, I hope. So it's really great to chat with you.
People, hey man, it's my pleasure. And you know that I'm excited to be on your podcast because I shaved. I very rarely shave. People loved that appearance of you and Sagar. It was great. I enjoyed it. And yes, you're correct. I mean, I was just telling you that I have Sebastian Malaby coming on. You interviewed him a few weeks ago. He's going to be on the podcast in a few weeks for our episode. So we have a lot of common interests, and I'm just so excited to speak with you today.
Yeah. So speaking with common interests, I wanted to talk with you about what's happening in Ukraine, but not just from a tactical, what's specifically happening day to day, because let's be honest, effectively, no one literally knows. Like on a couple levels, this is really up to highest level leadership here. But I want to talk about the world within which this conflict or potential conflict is happening, because I did a call with a listener who's in college this weekend, and he was asking me all these questions about the conflict. And eventually it just came out that, and I'm just bad at math, so I didn't think about this, he was 1 year old when September 11th happened. So everything we're talking about here, 1990s NATO expansion, the Cold War, inception of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which definitely shades a lot of the way people think about this issue, was just totally decontextualized. So let's talk about this conflict within that broader context. So let's just start here. I'd love to hear just what is your take as regards to the broader Ukraine discussion and the conflict?
Well, that's a really, really, really big question. I guess, I mean, there obviously are a number of takes. The one thing that has immediately bothered me has been the misinformation. And this is a really difficult subject to try and tackle, because I'm making that statement from a place of being informed from sources that might be misinforming me. So I have to try and do my best to figure out what is true and what isn't true, or more importantly, who's trying to game me and how. That might be the more important question to ask. And I think what a lot of people have made, you know, and I can understand where they're coming from, because I also grew up, I was a freshman or a sophomore in college during 9/11. So So the 9/11 attacks, the war in Iraq, the 2008 financial crisis shaped me profoundly. And yet, I find that a lot of people tend to use those experiences to anchor their views on everything else. And so whatever Joe Biden or the Biden administration says, whatever Vladimir Putin or the Russians do or the Chinese say, they filter everything through those biases. And so a perfect example is when the Pentagon press secretary, you know, came out and said famously now that the Russians are planning a false flag attack. And the AP reporter questioned him on that and said, you know, we remember weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. We remember Kabul will not fall. He gave him very good pushback. And the defense secretary didn't have anything really good to answer, to respond with. A lot of people saw that. And rather than simply acknowledge it for what it was, which was that the administration was trying to say something for which they probably didn't have any evidence, they didn't think for, and then they immediately said, well, they're just warmongering. That became the narrative. What they didn't understand, and I think what a lot of people are failing to grasp, but fortunately, I think the administration is actually engaged with, which is something that I think America has been late to the game on. We are in a new, for lack of a better term, total war. And the primary frontier of that total war is in the information space. And right now, what the Biden administration is doing, in my view, and my view, again, is informed from the perspective of people that I speak to. So I try to gather the best information I can from people that actually are primary sources and do my best to use that to understand what's going on. I think the Biden administration, they seem to me to be acting pretty adroitly insofar as battling the Kremlin in this information landscape, in the memosphere, in the narrative realm. Because I think what again, people fail to appreciate about Russian propaganda and how it operates, it's not about trying to conceal their actions. The actions of the Russians are available, there's a whole world of open source intelligence that can show satellite footage, social media posts, and also the Kremlin itself. It's press conferences going to Geneva. And yet there's a giant contingency of Americans who think it's all fake, that it's all getting drummed up, that it's not real. What people don't realize is they're not trying to conceal their actions. They're trying, the goal of Kremlin propaganda, as I've come to understand it, and also I worked for a Russian organization. I worked for Russia Today. I worked within the bowels of the Russian media system. I mean, the phrase question more, which is part of RT's slogan, which I, when I had started, thought of in the more charitable sense of, you want to question things, and you should. I think for it, that is quite literally the totality of what Russian propaganda is. It's question everything and lose all sense of truth so that you become completely confused and you no longer can actually agree on what is or what is not an invasion. What is or what is not a hostile action? So the gathering of over 100,000 troops on the borders of Ukraine, where professionals with credentials who you may never have heard of are telling you that this is a forced posture, you are able to wave away because you say, well, who knows what's true? I don't know what's true. And also America, Iraq, 9/11, weapons of mass destruction, I don't believe it. That happened there, so I'm not going to believe this. And just to kind of to try to draw a point here, all those things are true. We have absolutely been let down. We've been lied to by our leaders. But we are in a new world now. This isn't the unipolar world that we were living in before, where our primary enemy was American surveillance and sort of the totalitarian urges of the Bush administration. We are now in a new world where we have to navigate multiple enemies, both within and without, if we think of ourselves as sovereign individuals. And that requires a whole new framework for thinking about the world, and it requires way more critical thinking and judgment on the part of all of us, including challenging on a regular basis all these narratives that are flying at us.
Man, so many things that I really appreciate you saying there. Let's just go in no particular order. I really was so frustrated at the point you just made around, well, there's literally hundreds of thousands of troops on the Ukrainian border. There was a prior invasion, which no one disagrees happened in 2014. There's a effective or probable naval blockade that's in the offing. And to basically just say things like, well, where's the proof? Just seems to be entirely crazy. It seems to me that the prove you're not going to war thing should be directed towards Putin in that case, not the other way around. I was listening to a World War II history book by Andrew Roberts, and this might not feel like it's that particularly important, but when Germany invaded Poland, like they attempted to use a false flag attack to say that there was a specific incident on the border. You know, when Stalin at first was afraid, when the Soviet Union was invaded by Nazi Germany in 1941, Stalin was afraid that these were false flag attacks, or possibly there were people in the German staff who weren't doing that, this wasn't Hitler. So there's a long history of aggressive powers using misinformation, disinformation tools to advance themselves. So it's just really frustrating that people are taking, like you said, justifiable frustration from 20 years of largely failed wars in the war on terror to juxtapose it there. So I think that's really, really frustrating. But I want to speak to something which you just said, which is, I'm so interested by your use of the word misinformation. Because if you go through your social media, if you look at the guests you talk about, the topics you're interested in, on paper, you should be someone who's very skeptical of the way the word misinformation is used in the American domestic political context. Mm-hmm. So oftentimes you are someone who I would expect to be skeptical of the way Twitter, Facebook, et cetera, police themselves. Yet you're using misinformation. And mm-hmm. the reason why you're doing that, and I'd love to hear your specific articulation, is the reason why you're doing that is you're able to separate Rachel Maddow, Russiagate discourse mm-hmm. from what's happening on the ground in Ukraine. But can you just talk about that from your personal perspective? Because the fact that you're doing that is just so critical.
Yeah. So on a high level, I think in order to try and explain myself here, I want to say that what's happened is that a lot of words that used to mean a lot of things, or used to mean things, don't mean anything anymore. Because they've been cheapened, they've been perverted, they've been misused, and they've been applied in all sorts of areas. And misinformation is a classic example. And so in some sense, what I really want to try and do, whether it's in this conversation or anywhere else where I use this word or any other, is I actually oftentimes try and come back to first principles and try to really say, well, what am I saying here? Please break all those associations in your head when you think of misinformation. Don't associate them with political activism. Truly, what is people can be misinformed, and information can be misinformation if it misinforms you, whether that's on purpose or not on purpose. And we simply know as a fact that, or we should, everyone should know, we are all imperfect beings trying to make sense of a changing world in an environment where more and more of underlying reality is intermediated with layers of technology and algorithms that are interpreting reality for us. We were always imperfect beings in being able to understand the world. That's the truth. I mean, this has been, in fact, I should just say I did an episode on this for a good reason with David Chalmers, the existentialist, on the nature of reality, because we don't fundamentally have the ability to know for sure what is and what is not real. And this is the starting point. But that's only become more difficult in the world we live in today. So I feel like that, I don't know if this is answering your question, but I approach everything with a level of humility, but also at the end of the day, we have to be able to come to agreement on things in order to move forward. And this, to bring it back to the point about the Russians, this is how Russian propaganda works. What it attempts to do, it attempts to prevent that congealing, that solidification of views, from preventing people to arrive at a consensus view of what the world is, imperfect as it may be, so that we can move forward and make decisions, to be caught in this muddled middle. And that's where America is at the present time. And it's a very dangerous time for us to be caught in that situation.
So let's just set the table then and ask you, what do you think Ukraine's relationship with NATO, the West, Russia, you know, what do you think, as it appears, this conflict could be de-escalating? I need to be very precise here. We're recording this at 10:17 a.m. on Wednesday, the 16th of February. Right now, it appears as if the conflict is de-escalating. Moving forward, what should our relationship be with Ukraine?
Yeah, appears is the word, right? Because it may appear that way exactly because that's how it's meant to appear. It's not clear to me that that's what's going on. I haven't been up to date on the very latest facts and information, but from the last information I saw, the U.S. intelligence agencies were saying that they were seeing no evidence that Russian troops were moving back to their bases, or at least that the force posture was changing in any way that was meaningful for an attack. So I just want to put that out there. But could you ask what that last part of your question was again? Because that I heard that and I just wanted to clarify it.
Yeah, no, and that's actually the proper setup. This is why it's good to talk with podcast hosts. They are good at setting up context. So that context is very important. I should have added that myself. Bad Marshall, but here's the actual question. Knock on wood, hope that this de-escalates. Moving forward, what do you think our relationship with Ukraine, our means the West, it means NATO, it means the United States. What is your ideal state for Ukraine?
Yeah, big if. But if so, I think one of the challenges that's happened is because the Russians have been so aggressive in their posture, it's made it difficult for the Biden administration to reconsider a stance that it's had, that the U.S. government has had for a very long time, which is questionable, which is the expansion of NATO eastward and the legitimate threat that the NATO alliance and the possible inclusion of Ukraine poses to the Russian government and to Vladimir Putin specifically. And again, these are interpretations that I have, not the NATO threat, that's long established, but I think my interpretation is that Vladimir Putin, for example, sees Ukraine as a threat, not simply because NATO as a military alliance may potentially join the alliance, but because democracy itself is a threat to authoritarian governments. And so I think it's important to revisit that relationship, to revisit the guarantees. Like, why, for example, has the United States not been willing to say that Ukraine will not join NATO when we are not willing to defend it militarily? This is the thing that's confusing to me, right? We have this weird situation now where the Russians are saying, we're going to invade Ukraine. Well, they're not actually saying it, but we all know that that's what they're saying, that we're going to invade Ukraine unless you make certain concessions, the most important of which, the basic starting point of which is that you will make a guarantee that Ukraine will not join NATO. You will, at this point, acknowledge that, again, to bring it back to the original grievance, the promise that was made by the Bush, supposedly by Bush 41, to Gorbachev, which was that NATO will not move one inch eastward, to end that eastward expansion, to promise that Ukraine will not join. If that's what they're asking for, what I don't understand is we're prepared to allow the Russians to invade and take Ukraine because we're not willing to defend it, but we're not willing to acknowledge that we're not willing to say that we will never allow Ukraine to join NATO. It's a confusing condition in my view, and I think it's put the United States in a difficult position now. And this is all part of the larger context, which is we are no longer a unipolar power. And so we have these frameworks in our head about what the role of the United States is in the world and what is and what is not allowable. And what our power is and where we should expect to have a say or not have a say. And the world has changed dramatically. The Russians are testing the boundaries of this new multipolar order. The Chinese will and will continue to do that. One thing that I've not heard anyone talk about, and I don't speculate on it because I haven't heard anyone say it, but it seems odd to me that it hasn't been brought up, which is, could there be any kind of collaboration here, communication between Moscow and Beijing? I mean, does Putin have any concept or sense of what might transpire across the Taiwan Strait in the next period of time? And is this an opportune moment for him in addition because of that? I don't know. But so I think our posture with Ukraine should be, our relationship to Ukraine should be rethought, I think. At least we should ask ourselves these questions. And we should have and I think the Biden administration is, in a way, internally having this broader conversation about what the role of the United States should be in this new multipolar world.
Yeah, I love the way you set that up because I've got a couple answers. So one, no one, and I mean absolutely no one, thinks that Ukraine, or Georgia for that matter, will be in NATO. NATO ascension requires affirmative consent from every single NATO partner. And if there is a country, the existence of Germany means that there is zero chance. So I get your point about the US and what Biden wants or what the State Department wants, but given the way NATO is structured, it doesn't really matter, because what we know for certain is that Germany and various other Central European countries would not welcome Ukraine or Georgia into NATO. If Putin has made one thing very, very, very clear, it's that the red line just exists there, right? So this is the invasion of Georgia in 2008. This is the seizure of Crimea in 2014. And now it's this conflict. The fact that the U.S. isn't even willing to put, and I do not support the U.S. putting troops in Ukraine, but that has just made this very clear. And I think this speaks to my frustration with people who spend a lot of time splaining for Putin in the sense of Putin feels aggrieved and we, you know, weren't nice enough to the Russians in the 1990s or the 2000s, and we were a little too gloaty. There's a degree of that that's true, but Putin himself as a person, as an authoritarian leader with seeming unipolar control over Russian foreign policy, is acting in complete bad faith, because he knows he has gotten what he got, what he wanted the second that Biden said, we are not going to put U.S. troops in Ukraine. It was over. So moving forward, I agree with you that Georgia, Ukraine, these are not going to be in NATO, nor the, I would, if I were president, I would vote, or however NATO works, I would vote against allowing that to happen, therefore preventing that from happening. Germany would do that. That being said, I think there's a difference between us acknowledging in private or publicly as pundits on a podcast that that is the truth. It's another thing to state in the face of hundreds of thousands of troops on a border, we, the undersigned, for all time, swear, regardless of context, regardless of Putin's kind of an old dude, regardless of what Russia looks like in 20 years, will never let Ukraine into NATO. That seems to me to not only be kind of a weird thing to promise, because that make that much sense as a promise, but B, it also repeats the mistake that James Baker made in the 1990s, right? So you're referencing before the fall of the Soviet Union, James Baker, Secretary of State, is meeting with Gorbachev, the head of the Soviet Union, and he says, hypothetically, we could not move one inch forward into Warsaw Pact countries, East Germany, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, if the Soviets give up these countries. Here's the thing. You can't promise something like that. That was a huge... So whether or not that was the proper policy, even though I could love to hear your take on this, what's so frustrating about this conversation is, guys, like, James Baker, A, wasn't even the president. So this isn't George H.W. Bush specifically stating in writing, we will not advance forward. This is a hypothetical conversation by a person who is not even the president. They're not the vice president. Secretary of State's pretty high up there, but it's not actually someone who has authorization. There's no resolution that passes Congress. There's no agreement. This just happens. And as we all know, no administration in the U.S. can make a promise for all future administrations. So at best, and this ended up happening, whatever H.W. Bush had to say only was valid so long as he was president. And then a year or two later, Bill Clinton is president, and Bill Clinton has a completely different take. So this idea that democracies with our structure of government can make that type of promise just is not true. And that's just not valid. You know, who can do that promise? Putin can do that. I wouldn't trust him, but Putin can make promises because of the structure of his government, determines everything. I don't trust authoritarians. That's my lesson of the 20th century, like, you know, all power, corruption, all those things. But she can make a promise for the CCP right now. But Biden can't make a promise. James Baker can't make a promise. Bill Clinton can't make a promise if it's forever. James Baker could say the George H.W. Bush administration will not support NATO expansion. Biden can say the Biden administration, they almost certainly said this in private. I guarantee they said this in private. The Biden administration will not support Ukrainian NATO membership. But I just am frustrated when people like Tulsi Gabbard say, all Biden has to do is make this promise. But that promise isn't valid. And that promise, in the case of James A. Baker, actually led to the problem we're in today. So that's my reaction, but I'd love to hear your response.
Yeah. Well, Tulsi Gabbard is a good example of something that I was talking about earlier. I like Tulsi. I'm sure she's a really nice person, but she's a classic example of this, of, okay, you're kind of stuck in like 2003 to 2006. It's like, everything is about, we were lied to go to the Iraq war, the U.S. warmongers, but this isn't 2003. The U.S. isn't a unipolar power. There are other threats in the world, and the situation has gotten more complicated, and she should know that as well as anyone. I think your point about promises is such an intelligent observation. I would just qualify it by saying that there is a range of, there is a kind of range of conviction around promises. First of all, totally agree. I think this has actually been a source of conflict between the leadership in Beijing and Moscow and the United States, which is that they attach more, I think, durability to such promises. But there is a range of durability, and that's based on legislation. So there are things that, there are certain promises that we have made that have lasted decades because they're instantiated in legislation, informal alliances, et cetera. But yes, I agree, and it's a worthwhile, point to note.
So here's the follow-up, because I want to be good faith here and answer people who are skeptical of our position's responses, so I'll channel them. You specifically, when you were saying, let's qualify the idea that de-escalation is happening right now by citing the intelligence community. And I knew, because we both know our audiences, that there was a decent number of people who said, Dmitry, are you kidding me? You're citing the same intelligence agencies that said Kabul wouldn't fall? The same intelligence? And once again, I think there are parts of the look at what happened in Iraq discussion that aren't helpful, but I think a part that is helpful, and I think will stand the test of time, is natural and reasonable skepticism of empirical claims from any type of intelligence agency in a complicated world. It's not World War II. It's not the 1940s. We cannot hold. I mean, you saw what happened, right? Actually, it's kind of funny. Like, the reason why the Church Committee happened in the 1970s is we trusted the CIA and intelligence agencies too much, and things went absolutely insane during the 1960s. So I think the skepticism is deeply important. But why? What is your response to people who basically say, Dmitry, I am just unwilling to trust anything an intelligence agency says, given everything that's happened?
Yeah. Okay. So I just want to point out something else again, which is that these types of just black and white statements are ridiculous on their face if you actually think honestly and you ask yourself that question honestly. You know, just because there's nothing that an intelligence agency could have possibly done that would have will make you, if you're being 100% honest, that should make you shut off your brain 100%. But anyway, that aside, I want to make a distinction here between Kabul will not fall, and there are 100,000 or 150,000 troops on the Russian border. The first claim requires a level of judgment that the second claim does not. The second claim can be more clearly empirically validated. So what matters to the second claim is this public or private intelligence? Is it available to the public or is it not? And then if it is, the question is, can you validate that information? And we have an enormous amount of open source intelligence that shows unequivocally that the Russians have mounted an assault army. And now the assault army. I'm not a military guy. I can only take the words of lots of people who look at that data and say this is definitely, for reasons of like the amount of gasoline that they brought with them or this, that. This is an invasion. This is an invasion force. It's not a drill. So that level is interpretation. But that requires a level of trust, and I kind of disperse that trust across a whole network of people who I previously trusted and have a certain amount of respect for. So that's my answer to that question.
No, that's really valid, and I really appreciate, if there's a theme throughout this episode that I hope people are picking up on, it's this idea of how do you get to a place of confidence. Confidence in the statistical sense, confidence with regards to how you're thinking about the world when there are all these competing aspects too. So the point is, once again, I love your distinction between a prediction, an analytical prediction of we've added up the troop forces and we think that the fighting season in Kabul will last this long and we think the poppy production will be such so the Taliban can sustain forces. Like that's how that process works when it comes to analysis. That, to your point, is different than, no, but seriously, it's open source, actually verifiable that there are certain emplacements, setups. We could see where the naval positionings are. We can see on the ground, et cetera, et cetera. That's very, very, very helpful. And once again, this is also what distinguishes the kerfuffle over the false flag attack, because that is a specific tactical instance that is different than, once again, the context that is happening under. The Biden administration. Yeah. Go,
it's also a prediction. It's an interpretation. And this, again, speaks to, to what we've done. We've shot ourselves in the foot. We have destroyed words. There is such a thing as science. We've destroyed that word. And you can, if you can falsify claims that there is no Russian threat mounting on the border, and someone falsifies that claim with evidence of it, literally hard evidence that you can look at, that's not the same thing as saying there's going to be a false flag attack. That's not the same thing. Okay. And people have lost the thread. They've lost that thread. They can literally doubt that there are, they can doubt the, and okay, if you're, and then if you're, if the conditionality around which you doubt it is that you doubt that that piece of data has not been reconstructed, well, then fine. But that's the argument you need to put forward, and then we need to try and figure out if in fact that's true, or try to work around that. But that's not what's happening here. There's just a general distrust, and people and unfortunately, because of the social media ecosystem that we live in, so many people get their sites of social standing or even their incomes by finding ways to confirm their biases and the biases that they have sold to their audience, which they've attached their credibility to, and their sort of I know everything credibility, because a lot of people sell themselves as experts. So you've got this whole ecosystem of people that make money and promote themselves by putting forward a very rigid interpretation of the world. And people follow those folks. And so you've got a giant problem when it comes to misinformation. And that word is not, I'm not attaching it to whenever the politicians use it to promote one particular agenda or another.
Yeah, which is, once again, we have to separate words. It's kind of funny. This seems like such a centrist, boring take, but words have meaning and they are actually important. And we can't, just because Rachel Maddow says something cringe, actually throw out whole words that are actually important. So I think that's an important pushback on the instinct. So another bit of pushback, and this is the piece of pushback that I just have let me put it this way. If you know nothing about our political system and the way the defense policy works, I understand why you would have this concern. If you are a person of conspicuous responsibility and you have this take, I have very little sympathy for you. Mm. But that being said, I'm going to try to channel it effectively. Dmitry, the past 20 years were a complete boondoggle for what we could broadly call not just the military-industrial complex, but the Beltway. People joke, and this isn't even a joke, it's actually very true, that there are a whole lot of McMansions that were built in the DC, Maryland, Virginia area based off of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And now that we see instances where you have like the CEO of Raytheon and an investor call saying things like, because of probable conflict in Ukraine, because of tensions with China, we think our stock is going to perform at unprecedented levels. People take these things and put them together and say the following. They say, Dmitry, why should we not just dismiss a lot of this as, once again, the MIC doing what the MIC is going to do, advance war, advance conflict in order to enrich itself and throw people's lives away?
Yeah, it's a difficult question to answer other than to ask, well, okay, what, so, sorry, just Marshall, say that last part again. Why shouldn't we, what was it? Just to.
Why should we enrich the okay. MIC and right. throw people's lives away? This is, right. I think that is basically the fundamental question.
Well, I hate those questions because it's an impossible question to answer. I never said that. You know what I mean? You never said that. We're not saying that we should enrich the military industrial complex. I hate those questions so much. So oftentimes on Twitter, I find myself in these situations, which is like, I said X, you said Y, do you believe in Y? I didn't say Y. You know, like I feel like we oftentimes need to literally do that, right? We need to literally use logic and replace words with characters and variables, because people, they hear what they want to hear. I don't think that we should enrich the military-industrial complex. I think that we all know as a fact that we've wasted trillions of dollars in treasure over the years. That doesn't mean that we aren't confronting a game theoretical landscape that is very dangerous. And throughout all of human history, people have gone to war. I mean, I think that the incidence of death by violence used to be like, it was like an enormous number.
Yeah.
Like if you look at skeletons of people like that died thousands of years ago, it's like there are axe marks everywhere. You know, there's like spear marks everywhere on their bones. Human beings are violent. You know what I'm saying? And so I think that there's an unwillingness to grapple with the reality of this. And unfortunately, because the United States has been a military empire for so long, and because towards the tail end of that period, just like the way that we printed and conjured out of thin air trillions of dollars in credit in order to sustain inequitable distributions of wealth and capital in our society and maintain an increasingly unfair system, we did the same thing with military deployments and with force structures. We depended increasingly on contractors. We got rid of I don't know why I'm forgetting the word. It's so funny. But when you versus enlisting, what do we call that again? Why am I blanking?
That
literally tells you everything you need to know. I can't even remember the word I'm trying to come up with.
Commission is an officer.
No, it's drafted.
Oh, draft. Right,
I literally couldn't remember the word. You know, we don't draft people. People don't get drafted. There's no sense of communal participation. And this again, I lost the thread of where I was going with this, but maybe I can just tie it off on this point. I think this is like the central problem. And maybe if I could just pick one, I would just say we are no longer a cohesive community. We have a national government, but we don't have, in a way, a strong enough sense of national, communal sacrifice and objectives and goals. And I think that tension is really creating a lot of dangerous problems, because America still is the strongest military power, but it's a shit show inside the country. So I'm sorry that I kind of went off there, but maybe you can help bring it back.
Like you said, that's the point of a long form podcast. Mm. No, because I think you set this up really well, because once again, you and I, obviously, I think we're pretty well synced on a lot of these questions. We have a perspective. People could have different perspectives. From my response to people who bring up the MIC question is that actually isn't the question right now. The question right now is, what is the US's relationship towards NATO? Does NATO make sense under its current structure? Does sending troops to Poland and the Baltic states, does that increase the chances that Putin will invade? Does that decrease the chances that Putin will invade? What do we think Ukraine should look like? Should it be a neutral buffer state? Should it be a member of the West? Should it be more friendly to Putin? Should Germany have the same economic relationship with Russia per Nord Stream 2? Those are the questions that actually deeply matter right now. And I'm just frustrated because, you know, AOC was on Mehdi Hassan's show and he asked her about Ukraine. And she literally started off by saying, we have to make sure the MIC doesn't profit here by pushing any of these things in any direction. And that to me got to my deep frustration with people from our cohort. Once again, not asking the right question. If you are left, right, center, far left, far right, the question at hand right now is not, frankly, in terms of like how precarious the world is right now, is not what exactly does the contract look like for the Javelin missiles that could go to Ukraine right now. I think that is the fucking least important question right now. Like I've been, I don't know about you, man, but I've been so... Like I wake up every morning and I just like desperately check Twitter, not because I'm like overly addicted to the platform, but because I'm afraid that the world that we grew up in just actually blew up because there's a war in like Central and Eastern Europe. That is what I care about. I do not care if there's some asshole in like McLean, Virginia, who has his second Tesla. I think that's a question that matters in the longer term. But if you are a member of Congress right now, and if you are a person who's shaping the discourse, if you start with that question, the last thing I'll say on this, and I'll throw it somewhere else, is, you know, why was Harry Truman? And this is what I want. Let's not just be critics. Let's say what I want. Well, here's my response to MIC people. Here's what this is the word I want to live in. Harry Truman became vice president, under FDR because it was either the Truman Committee or Truman Commission. During World War II, he aggressively went after the defense industry when it came to pilfering, when it came to bad contracts. Like he became known as the person who made sure that as we're building these massive contracts with Ford, as all this money is going on, as the defense budget is skyrocketing, he made sure that the effort was proper and everyone's T's and X's were getting crossed. that is what I wish people who hold the more centrist position on this issue that I held were focused on. I would like if there were a, I actually don't like that the MIC discourse has largely been confined to the far left and to the far right. I think this is something where, look, if you are like a center left Democrat or a center right Republican, if you want the US to have a more forward facing position in the world after 20 years of disaster that our generations went through, you should actually be a person who's leading the effort to say, like, look, like, I believe in this posture. I believe in this posture so much that I am aware of the fact that any hint of impropriety, any hint that trillions of dollars are wasted would demean my cause, would actually demean the effort I'm trying to do. And I want someone to pick that up. Now, I don't think that's the debate right this second, but I really hope over the next year someone could pick up that flame, because that I think that is the way to address it. It is not the question at hand, but it's one that, frankly, people who hold my point of view too often ignore. So I think that's where I basically come to.
You know, you said so many things that I wanna try and address, Marshall, and
take
I wrote
control.
A bunch of them down. Yeah,
your podcast host, take control.
First of all, I feel you, man. You know, I don't know that I wake up checking Twitter. I think that I do check Twitter. I check Twitter all the time. But I think, yes, I oftentimes think, you know, I have literally like visions of atomic weapons going off, or of my generator. I have a generator at home being attacked. Because it's part of a, because I still have it online. I've wanted to take it offline, but we installed it not long ago, and I've wanted to continue to monitor it, and so I've kept it online. So I have that underlying anxiety, and I think a lot of us have that underlying anxiety, and I think it accounts for a lot of the sort of, it impacts the zeitgeist in America. I think, you know, the thing about what you said about AOC is a great example. And I want to tie it into Harry Truman as well, because he's a good person to sort of compare it to. There's a moral righteousness that comes with being absolute, and there's a privilege that comes with being absolute. Reality is messy, and morality is not. You can't live your life with absolute morality, of the kind that I'm about to try and attempt to explain. So Truman's a great example. Harry Truman dropped two bombs on Japan. And for that, he has been, by many people, permanently sort of excoriated as a villain in history. But Harry Truman could have dropped three bombs. There were actually three bombs that could have been dropped on Japan. And he made the decision not to drop the third bomb, despite advice by some of his military advisors to do that. Harry Truman made a decision between dropping two and three bombs. Now, an absolutist would say you should have not dropped any bomb. And we can go back and examine the history. I know that there are people that think that he didn't have to drop those bombs. It's a very easy, you know, view to have from this privileged place that we live in today. A privilege, another word that's been misused and misunderstood. Think about the level of privilege that our society has relative to the one that was alive in 1944. Okay, after all those years of war, death, destruction, and uncertainty. Putting that aside, he made a decision. He made a moral choice that he didn't need to drop a third bomb and he could save more people. Yes, he already dropped two. You know, I'm reminded of a professor I had in college who I'm so grateful that I have him. There's no way, I don't know what the man, how the man, I saw him recently at NYU and he still teaches. I don't know how he does it because he was so politically incorrect. But I remember he was my professor of foreign policy. And he put forward a thought experiment because there was one or more sort of moral absolutists in the class. And he said, let me ask you something. Let's say there's a plane that's flying over DC and it's got, you know, some chemical weapon in it. And if it crashes, it's going to kill hundreds of thousands of people. How many people are you willing to kill in order to prevent that plane from landing? And there are people that would say none. But, you know, I would ask this question like this. How many lives are worth saving for you to deliberately kill one person? 1,000? 10,000, a million, a billion? If you say no to every single one of those questions, then I'm afraid you don't belong in the realm of politics and decision-making in the real world. Because unfortunately, these are the decisions that people like this have to make on a regular basis. And the kind of moral righteousness and absolutism that a lot of people have been able to have the privilege to seek refuge in all of these years is a position I think that only can only survive in a unipolar world where it's just America and basically all the bad things that happen in the world are the collateral damage of our mismanagement. the world that we live in today requires many more hard choices, and people are going to either have to become comfortable making them, or I would implore them to just simply not participate in the public conversation.
Here's what I'd love for you to do, because you've made reference to this unipolar world a couple of times. Do two things. One, really describe what the world looked like in 2003, right? So like, not from the perspective of this unipolar, so like, not like, I don't mean a full pop culture rundown, American Idol happened. People could figure that out on their own. But just when you're talking about this unipolar world, not the great one, not the like the US rebuilt Europe and then we protected South Korea. We know that one, that's the ideal version. But talk about like that, the 2003, it's running on fumes and leads to disaster, and compare that with the world we live in now. Because I just totally agree with you. But so much of my frustration with critics of the current U.S. foreign policy is effectively that they are perpetually either living, well, it's A, like they're just like living in Howard Zinn's world. So everything is about what happened in Guatemala and overreach in Iran in the 1950s. And I don't know, this isn't a particularly coherent question. I asked the question, but I'll just finish the not particularly coherent thought and just say that at a certain point, man, like we weren't alive doing so many of these things. And I at a certain point, and obviously this, we need to have a different conversation about domestic politics and race and like those other different topics there, but like, especially in foreign policy, right? AKA where there are other actors, where there are other people who have votes in ways that just isn't true in US domestic politics. You and I literally had nothing to do with what happened in World War II. Nothing to do with Vietnam, right? Like, look at our two last names. I'm adopted, obviously, but like my black side and my Jewish Ukrainian side, obviously were not in the halls of power when those decisions were made. I'm not sure your family was particularly like relevant in that context either. So I don't want to be, I don't want to have to respond to overreach that the Dulles brothers did in the 50s. I can acknowledge it was bad, but I have nothing to do. I know. So let me put it this way. There is obviously a moral, there's a moral weight, right, to being an American. Like, we live in the world that America made. That is true. So yes, if you're an Iranian and you do not like that the Shah was overthrown, you and I as Americans, the listeners as Americans, we obviously have some type of moral weight there. But I should not, when I make my decisions, have to make every single decision with the fact that some dudes made a bad call in the 1950s. I think that's what, and it goes to the point you're making around, if that's your obsession, it sounds like you should be a writer of history books, not a person who's making decisions where lives are at stake. So yeah, I just love for you to, there's so many incoherent things there, but just like respond to it, please. Whatever you want
to
pick up.
We're going to have to work our way through this one, Marshall, because you know, the first question you asked was about what it was like in 2003. And but I want to make one other observation about the people, like you mentioned, the Dulles brothers. You know, we fail to appreciate that these people were broken. Broken men and women mended together. They had just come out of the most destructive war in human history, and they were facing down. And what welcomed them from that war? The prospect of total global annihilation. We have zero appreciation. We have absolutely zero appreciation. And I just don't think people, I just think, and this actually brings some, this makes me think of something that I've talked about on the show many times and which genuinely concerns me, which is that I just feel like a lot of people are checked out. The capacity for total destruction has not been mitigated. It's actually grown. Our systems have become more complex, and the pathways of destruction have become one way to put it is more vulnerable to states of criticality. And so I just want to kind of make that point. You asked about 2003. Again, the major sort of thing I just want to point I want to make is that we had the luxury in 2003. I read Howard Zinn, loved People's History of the United States, read Noam Chomsky, loved his books, Gore Vidal, Chalmers Johnson, you name it. I cut my teeth on those guys, okay? I watched Democracy Now. I loved Glenn Greenwald. I loved the perspective of people who were writing about Seymour Hersh. I mean, I was steeped in all of that, but that
you
was
for RT, to your point.
And then I later worked for RT, but it's interesting. We can talk about that and what my ideological evolution was by the time that I agreed to create a television show on the RT network. But I had not come from the progressive point of view. I came then from a libertarian point of view because I had become so disenchanted with the response of the Obama administration, which I had voted for in the first term. And again, not completely, naively. It's a complicated conversation. But okay, so we had the luxury in 2003 to sit around in college dorm rooms and talk about these high ideals and fight amongst ourselves and criticize our government at the expense of everything else because we were the primary movers of the world. It was appropriate. Today, the conversation has to expand. It cannot simply continue to be framed in the same way because we are not the only actors in it. And it's not just the, quote, Russians. Again, the Russians is a word you can't even use anymore because the American left completely just destroyed it. I mean, it's ironic because in 2012, Mitt Romney ran on the same kind of hyperbole. And I remember watching him bringing up Russia and Putin and Russia and Putin. And I was like, what the hell are you talking about?
Obama really dunked on him during the – Obama was one of the best dunks ever. Obama's like, dude, like 20th century called, man. Like
The 1970s are calling. They want their foreign policy back.
Yeah. Sorry,
guns and bayonets and everything else. Yeah, I mean, 100%. But he was pandering. I mean, Mitt Romney was pandering at the time. So, and that's the thing about Obama that, like, you know, for all his faults, and he has many faults, and he's been, you know, this is my view, my opinion. He's been such a disappointment. After his, what's been more disappointing about Barack Obama, there were a lot of things I actually liked about Obama's foreign policy. Believe it or not, a lot of hawks criticize his foreign policy. I thought he did a really great job, given the situation he was in, given the legacy that he inherited. And I think he operated also with good faith. So all that aside, I miss his charisma. I do miss his coolness, and I miss his strength. And I think that, you know, for all the substance, which is important, having that is important. And I feel like, you know, I don't know if you watched Joe Biden's speech last night on Ukraine. Did you see it, Marshall? It was an 11-minute address to the nation. And I thought that the words were powerful, and I actually appreciated it. You know, you said something in your appearance on Hidden Forces, which I really appreciated. We didn't delve into it, but I can't quite properly articulate it, but I had said something, and then you responded by saying, or you maybe something you said about something that Obama said, but the point was you were appreciating the moral clarity, and you were actually saying, I wish that he had been more clear morally. Because Obama had said something like, well, oh, I understand.
I remember what I said when we said
yes, the relative experience or something, right?
Yeah, yeah. I was basically just whining about my exhaustion with the hemming and the hawing and the – because once again, this is the key thing. You and I are doing an episode, which I think people are going to appreciate because we're acknowledging complication and there are different factors. I think it's exhausting seeing this from our leaders. I think it's really exhausting seeing this from our leaders. I think it's exhausting when they're what I just want is a higher degree. It's like you said at the start of the episode, man, like Iraq war, financial crisis, COVID. If you're a leader, right, which operationally makes you part of an establishment, like whether, you know, Trump is establishment, whether or not people like that branding, it's hard to just have confidence right now because basically every single thing you believe has been shaken. To its very core, if not completely collapsed. But I hope what starts to come out of this moment with people getting better frameworks for thinking through these things is we start to rebuild whatever those certainties are or confidences. They don't have to be certain, but they're confidences. That was more what I was frustrated around.
Mm-hmm. Totally. And again, speaks to the point about those who want to divide us as a nation, as individual groups, want to sow uncertainty. I think what you're pointing to is that there needs to be a certain kind of moral clarity, and we live in this world of relativism. But again, to kind of bring it back to my point about Biden, I thought there was a lot of moral clarity in his speech and badly needed sense of direction and mission and clarity around that. I loved the words of his speech. What really, really pained me was how old and feeble and sort of biologically not up to the challenge he appeared. And that's a real thing. You know, we're in this period right now, and who are our choices? This old guy, God bless him, he's old and feeble, he doesn't convey strength. And then Donald Trump, who for whatever your views of Donald Trump are, and I'm not here to you know, I have nuanced views on Trump's policies. Trump himself, I have always seen him as an agent of chaos. He is not a unifier. Everything he does, he splinters. And here's a question for you, Marshall, because this is the question that we haven't asked in this conversation. And I've been asking it recently, and I think it's maybe one of the most important questions to ask, which is, why are there not better candidates? Where are the people that we all, I feel like there's so much room for agreement in our country. I just can't quite understand, and I'm sure you probably can give me a pretty good logical explanation for it, but why is the most charismatic person in Congress AOC? She's incredibly charismatic. I'm not saying that she's not, but why can't someone with that kind of charisma be better, in my view, better intentioned, more of a unifying candidate, being able to sort of deal with the nuance of these issues? And maybe this, honestly, this is the one place where I concede it just shows how naive I am. But go ahead. I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are on that.
No, it's not a naive question, because I think it's actually the not totally existential, but quasi existential question facing people right now, which is, here's the answer. I'm actually about to do an episode on AOC with New York Magazine people. They're releasing a book about her just this far in. It's actually like, I initially wasn't that interested, but it's actually a super interesting idea, treating her as this like very generational argument. It speaks to the question you're asking. And it's kind of funny. I actually met AOC for a second right after she won her primary, because I was working at a PBS show and she came on the show. And I think the honest answer is that this political moment is toxic and it destroys everything it touches. I think we actually live in a lost political decade where anyone who chooses to engage in this current process, where the parties don't work, as in the organizing structures. I know people, especially listen to these types of shows, don't like political parties, but at their best, political parties are coalitions of people who could come to some type of consensus and then enforce that consensus on politicians. So in an ideal world, to your point, there's so much common ground, a political party would be able to seize the moment, as Republicans could in the early 80s, as Democrats did under Bill Clinton in the 1990s, and say, hey, like, let's come up with a set of ideas that 50 plus 1% of people are down for. Like, that is what a political party should be able to do. They can't do that today for a variety of other reasons. We'll have to do on a different episode. But it's just the environment. So, and I appreciate your nuanced take on Joe Biden, because look, I like Joe Biden. And I think that the thing that people who don't understand, when they make the critique of Joe Biden, of everyone's too old and we need term limits and like get this guy out, do you want Pete Buttigieg to be the president right now? I'm not sure I want Pete Buttigieg to be president right now. Are you confident that, I'm speaking more to Democrats here, are you particularly certain that Kamala Harris would do a better job of the Ukraine situation? I'm not at all. I think that Biden has handled the Ukraine situation perfectly in terms of what hopefully is happening here. So I think it's the time we live in. And the thing that I'm very interested in is what we are doing as podcasters, and it seems pretentious, but it's also true. We're trying to take all these different themes and all these ideas and put them together into something coherent. That's deeply useful. And I don't think that any, and I think that actually is the key. There are eras where ideas and themes and history aren't particularly important. I think there are eras where they are incredibly important. If it's the 1990s and the Soviet Union fell, I think you can just chill and kind of do things because like the history is over and everything's like really great. High to the unipolar moment. You know, you're going to fight over Britney Spears' music videos, and I get that. But today, as a politician, you have to say, okay, holy crap. The institution I represent has no credibility right now. The party has no credibility right now. If I became speaker, or if I tried to get more leadership, I, by definition, would lose more credibility. So should I be an insurgent? Should I try to play by the rules, which is what AOC has done? What do I do? There's no consensus. And I think this is just a decade where, you know, we get this listener cue. And because I'd like to hear your response to this as we close out the episode. I think we're really at a decade where smart folks who are ambitious, we get a lot of this type of listener mail. I think your time is better spent doing something else. I think a world where AOC had not just gone into Congress, but had done something different with her talents and then gone into Congress is an entirely different world. Because I think from a pure talent, all those perspectives, she had the goods to do it. But by entering into this political moment, she fundamentally is not going to be able to pull off what she wants to pull off. The AOC who, honestly, you know what my take? I think AOC should have tried to be, I think AOC should have been a podcaster or a content creator. That would have been better off for her long term. Yeah, but I think that's actually the answer. And this is why, by the way, politicians are all becoming podcasters. I think I like, it's kind of funny. I told this joke at my high school reunion, but like my this is super embarrassing. Actually, my email address in high school was kozloff2020@yahoo.com. It's like a super. It's a such a. This is the most 2005 thing ever. No Google. I had my Yahoo address because I wanted to run for Congress. And it would have been during 2020. No one believes me when I say this. Everyone at high school dunked on me. You could not, I mean, you get paid as a congressman. You could not pay me to enter into the political system right now. Yeah. I think it is a total soul-crushing disaster. And someone has to do it, but Jesus, I don't want to do it.
I think you just answered it for me, man, because I would never either. Look at this. We live in a time where even people that aren't politicians are under the kind of scrutiny that political candidates would never have even imagined would have been possible, you know, 10 years ago. So I think for me, that's the single biggest one, because the right kind of people, I think the types of people that we want to lead us in a democracy and really anywhere are people with varied experiences, people who have done things that maybe they're not proud of, but they reflected on them, they learned, they grew. They didn't approach life with a moral absolutism. And they didn't approach life with a sort of the mindset of, let me construct a false reality, which I can then project upon the world and win election. You know, so I think it's hard.
Depressing articulation of what the skill set today is. I think that's really well said. Can you expand on that? I've never heard the let me project a false reality upon the world. I've never heard that before. Can you expand on that idea?
Yeah. I mean, it's my first time kind of trying to articulate it. So you'll excuse me if it comes out a bit jumbled. And I also want to appreciate something that you and Sagar both mentioned on your appearance to my show, which is that authenticity is a really powerful force in politics today and everywhere else. And one of the things that makes Trump so effective as a politician and Ocasio-Cortez so effective is they're authentic. Or at least I haven't met Ocasio, but I imagine she is. And authenticity is not the same thing as honesty. Honesty in the very literal sense of what are you saying? Trump can be dishonest, but it can be very authentic.
He's authentically dishonest.
He's authentically dishonest. And probably in much the same way that perhaps Putin is, although that might be a stretch. I don't know. So what I was just trying to say, the point I was trying to make is that reality cannot survive this moment. The reality of life, the reality of choices, the reality of like lived experience, who a human being is in the real world, is very different than the image that, quite literally in the image. I mean, if I FaceTime someone, I noticed in the last few months, my face looks Bambier. I use the Bambi, like Bambi. There's like a quality of like, I look prettier. You know, like, so to the point about intermediation, the messiness of the world, the messiness of life, of our skin, of our faces, of our characters, of our choices in life, our fidelity, our kindness, all these different things cannot survive the moment that we are in. And so it feels like the people that are able to make it in the public realm are those that are able to project a false reality. And rare, perhaps, is the candidate like Trump, who is able to be so bombastic and in so many ways insulting to people, and yet still win political office. But then again, I say this, and I feel like it's I have to caveat it in so many ways. But I think you understand my larger point, which is that the individual, I'll bring up, you know, Joe Rogan's actually a good example, and I'll bring him up. You know, Joe Rogan has been embroiled in controversy recently because of not only his takes on COVID, but because of his use of the N-word in multiple clips that were surfaced something like 26 times over the course of his time doing the show, as well as another clip, which I actually found a bit more, distasteful, is a very kind way of putting it. I'm not here to make excuses for Joe Rogan. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think it was appropriate to use the word in the context that he used it. But nobody's perfect. And so I feel like we all make mistakes. We all do so many things wrong. And if going to public prominence means that when you do something wrong, you're done, versus when you do something wrong, it's an opportunity for us to understand it, to talk about it genuinely, and to grow as individuals, as people, then we're not going to get anywhere. And that's just the reality, man. And that's my point about reality is messy. Like, reality isn't, you can't just be absolute about everything. It's just, this is the world. It's messy. People make mistakes. So many of the things that I thought that I had in my mind when I was a kid about, well, this is right, that's wrong. As I've gotten older, I've understood more. Oh, that's why that person over there who I thought was a bad guy actually wasn't a bad guy. He just had some trouble with this. He had some issues with that. He did the best he could. God bless him. Let him on his way. I will try and learn from his or her lessons and try to be better. And when I arrive at the end of my life, I hope that I could have done the best job that I did with what was available to me, that I learned the lessons, that I grew. I hope the people that I wronged forgive me. That sort of deeply, I don't know, I mean, it's almost kind of Christian in a way, or religious. There's a quality there of a sense of like our imperfections. You know, we're imperfect, and it pains me. It genuinely pains me. You know, I can't, if I actually convey to you the heartbreak that I feel sometimes around the way that we treat one another in the public sphere, you'd probably not believe me.
No, I mean, I want to echo all of that and just say that once again, like throwing this to the audience, what you just got at with the comment about feels kind of Christian, like, you know, with the secularization of American society, and obviously religion was never perfect, but we've actually lost a framework for forgiveness, for moving on, for how do we deal with sin and mistakes? I mean, even sin in the secular sense. And it seems to me that if there were to be a deeply, let me put it this way. If you're a young, ambitious 20 something, left, right, center, whatever, your time is better spent trying to figure out what that model would look like than posting about some policy idea that's never actually going to pass. Because the thing is, if you actually want the things you want to pass, like that's what I'm talking about with the foundation needing to be rebuilt here. The biggest thing that has happened to me over the course of doing this podcast is I started off this podcast literally launched at a think tank. I was obsessed with policy. I thought policy was just everything. I just really think this decade, what matters the most is leaders, leadership, et cetera, that understands that the political task of this moment is rebuilding the foundation upon which campaigns, elections, public discourse happens. That is much more important than the policy, because policy can only happen when those type of spaces actually occur here. And then look, like the other thing I really just close here with when it came to just like Rogan and it's all those things, the thing that I always think back to, and like, look, once again, I think the Rogan thing is super hard because I know it's like probably not the best idea to apologize for things in the current era. I think Rogan in both instances was right to apologize, even though I admit that. And this is what I hate about this moment. Tactically and strategically, all the people are like, oh, like you gave into the woke mob. How can you apologize? I'm like, dude, like that was like effed up. Like, and I want, you know, this is actually what I want to get to. I want to live in a society where I and other people could apologize and not have to think like, oh, but like from a pure PR, like good faith, bad faith discussion, like the lack of ability to do that is just really, really, really devastating. You know, like I've had things happen in my past, you know, And sometimes like a listener will like find it and they'll talk about it. And I can't apologize. It's really shitty. Like I can't, you know, there's this, if you want to have fun, search Marshall Kozloff Weekly Standard. There was this like campus scandal in 2014. Mark Hemingway covered it and people would be like, well, Marshall, like you, there's like you bullied like a freshman in college who's trying to run for student government. And I don't respond. I don't respond because the second I'm just like on tape being like, oh, I'm sorry for this, this and that, because I am sorry. It turns into fodder for people who are fundamentally acting in bad faith. And I want to live in a world, to your point, where I can actually, where I don't have to make that calculation, because it's spiritually, it's actually spiritually deadening and exhausting. And then the last actual bit here is, I'm sure you perceive this too, a fascinating phenomenon that I'm noticing more and more is that as we lean more and more into a society that's unable to have a model for forgiveness and moving forward, where you can't apologize, I'm seeing just this rise of these like squeaky clean, super boring, vanilla types who are just quiet and don't speak their mind in any direction. I'm not saying like, oh, like they're not willing to say, put it with it. This isn't about PC. I just mean that there's this like weird class of person who I know from high school, I know from college, and they are people who are going to run for office. I know this explicitly that they're going to run for office, but they don't have any scandals. There's no drama. There's nothing they're going to have to apologize for. And they are going to be some of the worst, most incompetent, not up to the task people you could ever imagine when they come into public life. And it's like really depressing that our current incentive system is selecting for them. It's actually saying that their specific proclivities and dynamics are what's actually valued, when I think at an empirical level, that just isn't true. The skill set of, can you be a hyper ambitious person, but also never get in trouble, not tweet something bad, not piss off this wrong part of the audience, not take this controversial position any sort of direction? That one there is not one we're going to be happy that we selected for moving forward. No offense to the law school students in the audience. I know there's a bunch of you, but I just know a bunch of people in law school right now who are sitting safe and dandy. You're going to run for office in your 30s and 40s. You're going to get elected, and you are just not going to have any ability to figure out what's going on in this country, in this world, because it's like I was saying with AOC. I think I actually, once again, I really like AOC. I wouldn't do an episode on her if I had like actual existential beef with her. But I think that a version of her who was able to confront the topics we're talking about without having to say, but like, do I want to work with Nancy Pelosi? Should I do the sit-in in front of her office with the Sunrise Movement? Should I fundraise for this candidate? Should I vote for this Israel legislation? Yes or no? All the decisions I just listed, which are decisions that people on the left are really pissed at her for, are decisions that prevent you from actually coming up with something comprehensive to address what we're doing with here. So, Dimitri, any last words? We started with Ukraine, but I think we got somewhere really interesting here. I'm not really sure what to title this episode now. But yeah, just close us out and we'll go from there.
I should say, you mentioned it earlier. I knew you were adopted, but I didn't know that you were adopted by Ukrainian Jews.
I mean, let me be super, super precise here. Dad's Catholic, so he's not Ukrainian. He's not Jewish, but I took my mother's last name because of that whole, let's say there aren't as many Kozloffs running around the world after the 20th century. Take with that what you may. It's pretty obvious what I'm referring to. My name is Marshall Aaron Kozloff. And the family, the family's descended from Ukrainian. Like I have the menorah from Odessa. This is interesting. I'm glad you actually brought that up, because I have a bias. It's weird that I have a bias with Ukraine, given everything, because I'm adopted, I'm black, but also like, let's say I was like my mother's biological child. Let's just say there's a reason why the Kozloffs left Ukraine at the end of the 19th century. The whole pogrom thing wasn't really great. So I would hold the same position I hold on Ukraine if this were Latvia, Lithuania, or Estonia. So I've pushed myself. I actually ask this question a lot. I'm like, are you, if your last name was not Kozlov and you weren't aware of Odessa, would you hold the same position? I would hold the same position. But yeah, it's weird, to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, so much. It's you're the beneficiary of a truly. Yeah, for again a word that's been so cheapened, multicultural background, and I think it's probably made you a much better person. So I guess to close off, I wrote down four different words that came up when you were talking. One was freedom, and I think that in many ways our freedom has been assaulted so that we haven't been our ability to choose to apologize has been taken from us. We've been told we have to apologize. And in so or don't apologize, because if you apologize now, but so the context around an apology has been structured in such a way so that it's cheapened it. It's made it so that we can't authentically say, I'm sorry. You know, I reflected on what I said. You're right. You know what? It's true. Like this, that, and let me see what I can do with that. I don't have an immediate answer for you, because if I did, it'd be fake. So let me just work through it as a human being. Let me grow. You know, let me give you a great example to the point about Joe Rogan. When I was a kid, I used to watch all sorts of comedians. And one comedian who I thought was hilarious was Andrew Dice Clay. And a lot of my friends thought Andrew Dice Clay was hilarious. And we used to do his whole like nursery rhyme stuff. I don't know if you've ever watched Andrew Dice Clay. Do you know who he is?
No.
Okay. He was a Jewish comedian who played this sort of Italian guy. And he was racist. He was homophobic. He was anti-Semitic. He was God knows what he was. He was everything. He was every single insult wrapped in one. And in 2013, my friend invited me to go see Andrew Dice Clay at the Beacon. It had been years since I'd heard Andrew Dice Clay. And I went and watched Andrew Dice Clay expecting I was going to laugh. And I couldn't laugh. And I didn't think it was funny. And I went home and I reflected on that. And I thought, you know, it's so interesting. Because I know there's like a whole assault on comedy, et cetera. Yes, I get that. And people need to also understand that comedy is about, you know, addressing things that, you know, you can't maybe address in normal conversation. It gets to the undertones. But I realized that I had changed. Like the things that I thought were funny before weren't funny to me anymore. You know, and I'd grown. I had changed. I'd experienced life. I had experienced individual human beings who deconstructed the stereotypes that allowed me to laugh at something that it was no longer funny. And people grow, people change, you know, and we have to understand that. We also can't expect people to be who we want them to be. That's what living in a free world is. They're going to be people that are fucking assholes. You're going to think that he's an asshole, and he might think you're an asshole for thinking he's an asshole. Well, that's his right, and that's your right. Do you have the right to offend someone? More importantly, you have the right to be offended. By being offended, you get to grow as a human being. You experience something inside, and it makes you think, it makes you reflect. So that's my first point. The second point is the spiritual dimension of all of this. You know, I think that probably came up in the context of forgiveness. And man, is that not something powerful? You know, offense is not taken, it's given. I mean, offense is not given, it's taken. And we can absolutely give forgiveness. And I think it's a powerful thing to be able to forgive. And it's not something that makes you less a person, it makes you a bigger person. And so I think, you know, that whole area of spirituality, we could just spend a whole episode on that. And about mortality, something else that comes up in the context of COVID. I think for a lot of people, COVID was the first time that they, you know, confronted the fact that they're going to die, and it freaked them out. And they constructed trade-offs in their heads that I think, you know, don't accurately reflect what matters in life, you know? I don't know what this one was. It looks like I have dimensions. Anyway, and culture. And I just want to end with this, man. You know, you and Sagar both talked about this on my episode. I thought it was so powerful. And I'm totally with you on it, which is that everything today is downstream from culture. And so to your point, being able to participate constructively in like as a podcaster, for example, I think in the work that you and I do in our positions as podcasters and as sort of participants in the public domain is very important. I think it's so important today. I take it seriously. I make all sorts of mistakes, no doubt about it. But I think, you know, people are looking for not only people they can trust, but also people that they can model themselves after. And I look to those people too. Like I have people that I model myself after who I say that person is behaving in a way in that situation that I would like to be able to behave. And so I'm going to try to learn from that behavior, get better, be a better person. And hopefully that behavior that I do gets carried on by someone else who sees me, because I know that there are people listening to me like I used to listen to other people when I was younger. You know, so, you know, I think we have an important role here. And I think people, we all need to take it seriously. Yes, you and I take it seriously, but even people on social media who are quick popping off, giving, you know, ridiculous opinions, or when I say ridiculous, uninformed views, you know, absolutist takes, should reflect on the fact that we all have a responsibility. We all live in a country like this, and we still have a democracy. We're not going to lose it overnight, I don't think, but we are degrading it, you know, and like it's our responsibility. There is no one else. There are no adults in the room that are going to take care of us. We're the adults. This is the other thing, and not to turn this into a giant monologue, but there is an infantilization that's been going on in our society. We, you know, like this kind of like we increasingly coddle ourselves and others. We take, I can't tell you how much I want to barf when I hear, I took a little me time. I get that some people might mean that in a way that's innocuous, but there's just something so much about myself, about me, you know, I looked out for me and mine. And I just think it's a small way to live your life. It's not expansive. It's not like forgiveness, which is expansive. And I think we could all benefit from that kind of expansiveness, open-mindedness, and just, you know, being able to grapple with the messiness of life, because life is messy. That's how I would finish that impromptu monologue.
Really well said, Dimitri. We'd love for you, just as we close out, just to shout out Hidden Forces, where people should go. You've launched on Supercast, which is awesome. So yeah, so please just give the quick rundown.
Yeah, so we Hidden Forces has always been a subscriber supported podcast. In the second or third year or so, I created a subscription model. We've never taken sponsors, and so you're correct. We moved from Patreon to Supercast, where people can subscribe to our premium tiers, which is how we support the podcast. You can find everything that you need to know about Hidden Forces at hiddenforces.io. The podcast is available on every major podcast platform, and we're also listed on multiple international airlines, United, Singapore, British, Cathay, a bunch of other airlines. So if you're ever on a flight, you can also find us in the in-flight entertainment system.
Oh, that's really cool. Well, Dimitri, thanks for joining The Realignment.
My pleasure, Marshall. Thank you so much for having me.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.